Pros and the know start with Lowe's, because at Lowe's, the more pros buy, the more they save. Need concrete for your next job? Get 20% off select concrete mix when you buy two pallets or more. Plus, save time by ordering online. Place your order at lowesforpros.com and it'll be ready for pickup at our pro desk when you are. Buy in bulk and save money. Buy online and save time. So, pro, now that you know, let's get started.
Of the Hope Illuminated podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention and mental health promotion, where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Sally Spencer-Thomas, and I am on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Today's episode is on resilience in the trans community, and I have an amazing guest and dear friend that I will be introducing shortly, Aidan Campbell, coming to us from D.C., and I'm pretty fired up about this topic because the numbers in regards to suicide are fairly staggering and often misunderstood. We know that approximately 41% of trans adults have at some point attempted suicide, and you compare that to the general population of about 4.6%, that's a pretty drastic difference. Even when you compare to the lesbian, gay, bisexual community at 10 to 20%, it's a huge discrepancy. And based on some really important research by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and others, we are really understanding this tragedy through a lens of social justice. We know that people who identify as trans who are also rejected by their family and friends have a much higher likelihood of suicide risk. And conversely, when they have strong support, they are far less likely to have any kind of suicide risk. But unfortunately, 57% of trans people are not speaking to or not able to spend time with their family, or their family's not speaking to them. Also, discrimination is a huge issue in the transgender population. About 60% of trans people say that they've been actively discriminated against, that their doctor refuses care, that they've experienced harassment in school and work and so on. They often don't have any of the legal protections that some other populations have, so this puts them at higher risk. Third, so we have rejection by family, we have discrimination, we also have a high incidence of physical and sexual trauma among this population. Assaults are very common, about two-thirds or more having assault experiences at work or at school. And then also, if people are seen or experienced as transgender or gender nonconforming, they have increased risks of suicide versus if they quote-unquote pass as cisgender. So again, this really speaks to the communities discriminating and making assumptions and stereotyping and so forth. And so all of this leads to a sense of internalized transphobia, which is also understandable given how our society is treating people who identify as trans. And then it gets even more complicated when you look at intersecting identities, the different minority identities of race and ethnicity. And so on. We know that people of color who identify as trans are also more at risk. So this really is a social justice issue. And while there may be or may not be overlapping mental health concerns, this is not really about fixing people as much as it is about fighting the injustice that leads people to despair. So I'm super excited to kick off my first podcast in season two, not only with the new music that you just heard, but with exciting interviewees like Aidan. And I will be also doubling the content over the next few months to see how I can manage that. So instead of just one podcast a month, you'll be having two. And so without further ado, I'm excited to introduce my friend and colleague, Mr. Aidan Campbell, calling us from a stormy Washington, D.C. today. Aidan and I have served for a couple of years together on the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline Consumer Survivor Committee, where we help advise this lifeline on all issues related to lived experience. And I've just been in love with him. He's just such a wonderful human. He is kind of the solidly silent voice of power in this committee. When Aidan speaks, everybody listens. Aidan was born biologically female and was actually went to an all-girls school in elementary era and realized early on there were some differences there, and these differences led to misunderstandings and confusion by his peers, and also depression and suicidality for Aidan that he just kind of kept underground for a long time. And then in 2007, stumbled upon a Newsweek article called The Mystery of Gender that was transformative and a turning point in giving him a new outlook on living. He went on to then become nationally known as an activist in the trans community and founded the Campbell Center in D.C., which is a peer-run agency that focuses on mental wellness and addictions recovery. He is also a suicide attempt survivor, so he also has kind of the lived experience of what it feels like to live through the darkest despair, and he's a lost survivor, losing many of his friends and colleagues in the trans community and also his partner in 2011. His life was highlighted in the New York Times in a recent article, so you can check that out. I'll put that on the podcast show notes. He was awarded the National LGBT Leadership Award at the Alternatives Conference in Austin, Texas, not too long ago, and he keeps going. So he has two social media campaigns that were pretty exciting and impactful in the D.C. area. One was hashtag Safe Bathrooms DC, and it was really to try to get some energy around the important aspect of turning bathrooms to all genders instead of single gender. He did this through his fellowship as the LGBT fellow of the Office of Human Rights. He also was a leader within the 2012 gender identity campaign to help people, trans people in D.C., have more visible presence for both safety and community advocacy. So I could go on and on. He has done so much to lead many folks into understanding the importance of trans rights and also wellness and recovery. So welcome, Aidan. How are you today?
Thank you, Chloe. I'm doing great. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here with you.
Yay. Yes, yes. So excited to have you here. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. So I want my listeners to know a little bit more about you. What was your life path like that led you to be this nationally known activist?
Still funny to hear you say nationally known because I just feel like I'm here in D.C. and this is my community and where I specifically do work. So it's still kind of odd to hear someone say, oh, I know you on a national level.
Well, we hung out mostly in Seattle. So I actually have you in my head based in Seattle eating Indian food.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit more.
Okay. So I was a kid that grew up in foster care, in and out of foster care most of my life, and actually ended up aging out of it, graduating high school at a Catholic Charities group home called Nazareth House. So most of my experience growing up, I experienced a lot of trauma. a lot of bullying because I was different. You know, the other kids saw me as somebody different because of the way I presented as far as my gender and sexual orientation. So I was bullied a lot because of that. So in foster care, the social workers and the people that ran the group home also didn't understand me. So I had a lot of issues in that area as well. And also, basically, I had to hide myself a lot just to make sure that I had housing, especially as a teenager, because I was told quite often that I could lose my housing if I was a lesbian or if I was caught having sexual relationships with another girl, that type of thing. Like, it was verbally said to me in a threatening way that you could lose your housing if by themselves. So I spent a lot of my time as a young person hiding my identity so much that I lost it myself, and it took me years to find it again. When I read that article in 2007 talking about gender and interviewing people, that when I read it, I realized those people were like me. You know, even young kids as young as 6 or 7. And so that article changed my life. It changed the path that I was on. And I was able to move into the identity of Aiden and start living full time as the person that I've always felt inside I was. So, yeah, that's pretty much
wow.
Me in a nutshell.
Wow. Yeah. And I thought, and I just read somewhere, or I'm going to have to pull this up, but it was really just in the last couple of weeks, some data that's coming out around brain imagery, and that the brains of often the brains of transgender people actually look like the brains of the gender they identify with. Did you see that?
Yeah, I have seen it, and I've actually seen a couple of articles about that and over the last couple of years. I haven't had my brain image, but I completely agree, and I can believe the science behind that, just because of the way I remember my brain being as a kid and now as an adult, like the way it thinks. And when I read things, you know, that separate gender, I'm like, wow, like, yeah, this is how I've thought all my life, like even before I knew that these things were kind of gender-specific or, you know, like thought to be gender-specific. So I definitely can believe that science. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty exciting finding. So there was the moment that you knew that you had, I don't know what the word is, permission or energized, or there were others like you that could live the way you've always felt you could live. Was there another moment where you felt that turning point of, I do this not just for me, but I also am standing up as an activist. I'm also standing up for others like me, when you started the Campbell Center. Can you share that part of your journey?
Years into after I started the Campbell Center, I realized, because at first when I started my transition in 2008, the thought in my mind was that I would transition and just kind of live my life,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a male, like just be out in society and just be living my life. But in 2011, I took on an intern, Lachey McLean, and she was a young 23-year-old trans woman. And one night in D.C., she was murdered in July. By someone that hasn't been found as of yet. She was shot early in the morning. And I remember going around D.C. with the well-known trans activist, Earlene Budd. And this Budd basically helped a lot of trans people in the community have funerals and memorial services by raising funds to make sure that can happen. And so I decided to assist Lachey's memorial and funeral services because we're so close, and she was our intern. And, you know, just going around talking to people in the community, you know, watching her family and her friends, and just seeing how open they were and how out and proud they were to live their lives as trans women, I realized that I couldn't be silent anymore. Like, I couldn't just fly under the radar. Like, I had to be more vocal and to speak out about the safety, especially of trans women, you know, who most of the violence is committed against. And so the death of Lachey was actually like a turning point as far as me actually coming out in public, saying that, you know, I'm a trans-identified man. I have, you know, lived experience being a suicide survivor. You know, all the things that involve activism around the trans community, trying to make sure that, you know, we're as safe as possible, you know, helping with the gender identity campaign and also helping to create, you know, a safe bathroom today as far as any type of activism around trans people.
Woo! That's an intense story. And, you know, my heart just pulls for the part of the story. I mean, it's all very intense, but the part of the story of the trans community coming together to make sure that people are honored after their death, as a place of gathering and community and solidarity and grief, that's important, and also very tragic.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's Iden up to today? Where are you? What inspires you today? What are you thinking about?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been in Seattle for the last 2 years, and so I'm finally back in D.C., and I'm so happy and thankful to come back to the community that I grew up in, because I've been in D.C. since 1990, and so this is basically where I grew up to become an adult and, you know, to become basically the person that you know today. So I'm just very thankful that I'm able to come back home and have time with the community here. So I am looking at what I can do moving forward, especially with the trans community, but also as a whole, the community of people that deal with mental health issues, deal with trauma, and also deal with suicidal ideation. What can I do for those communities as a whole, but definitely wrap the trans community into that, and especially the Black trans community / people of color, because we're the communities that are most devastated by suicide, violence, interpersonal violence, also trauma and mental health. So I'm working on some new projects. I am working on getting the actual physical space of the Campbell Center opened back up. I am also working with women now in D.C. That experience houselessness and trauma with M Street Village through a shelter called the Patricia Hand Place for Women. And we house over 251 women a night at the shelter. And it's a low-barrier shelter, which means that there are no conditions on the woman coming into the shelter. Like, she doesn't have to clean, she doesn't have to be in recovery or anything like that. She can just come in and have a place to shelter in overnight or for long term.
Wow. What's the name of that shelter again? The Patricia what?
The Patricia Handy Place for Women, and it's the low barrier shelter ran by N Street Village in D.C., and N Street Village is the largest provider for women's services in Washington, D.C.
Nice, thanks. So you've done a lot in your life. You've gone through a lot. You've lived through a lot. What is a professional highlight for you? What is something that you're like, you know, that was really important to me? I'm glad I got to be a part of that.
Oh, yeah. So Thursday I went to a celebration for Pathways to Housing D.C., and over the last 12 months, Pathways has housed 123 people in D.C. that have experienced houselessness or long-term homelessness. I was very excited to go because when Pathways opened in 2004, I was one of the first 8 staff to work there. And from 2004 to today, Pathways has housed over 3,000 people in D.C. The founder of Pathways, Sam Tavares, he created the Housing First model. And so I'm just really proud to, like, be a part, continue to be a part of that team through training with their staff, but also through, you know, helping to raise funds for them occasionally, and to see the growth that they have gone through as a team from 8 people to now about 110, 15 staff, but also from housing those first few people that we housed, those first 2 months that we were open, you know, 5, 10, 15 people, up to 3,000 people today. So that, to me, is like the type of legacy that, you know, anyone would be proud to be a part of.
And that's so important. I want you to expand on the housing first model, because I, the more I do this work, the more I am inclined to think that we need to think more broadly about social determinants to suicide prevention and mental health promotion, and housing is such an important part of that formula. Can you talk a little bit more about that, the model of housing first?
Yeah. Sam created that model in New York City. And, you know, he was working with the New York City government and decided that this was a model that could really work. And basically, it's very simple. Give people housing first, without any attached strings, without any preconditions, you know, saying that you have to be not using drugs, not drinking, not saying that you have to be involved in mental health treatment when you come into housing. Get the housing first, and then all of that, all of those things can come after. And so that's the simple, basic 101 for housing first. And so it was assessed in New York City. I think the early stat showed that people in housing and the housing first model and pathways retain housing up to 70% after the first year.
Wow.
And it increased. Yeah. And so about maybe a year or two in the New York City model, D.C. asked Sam to come down to D.C. and help them create a housing first model here. And so the housing first model was attached to the ACT treatment team. And so that's how Pathways D.C. was born, to utilize the housing first model and also the ACT model, which is assertive community treatment. And they've been very successful, like I said, in D.C., housing over 3,000 people in D.C., D.C. proper. And so basically, we bring people into housing without saying you have to be receiving mental health treatment. You don't have to be receiving any type of addiction treatment. You just come into housing, and if this is something that you want to work on with team and the social workers on that staff will help get connected to whatever type of treatments you need.
That's a very powerful model. When you think about, like, Maslow's hierarchy, the very basic thing we need first before we can do anything else is safety.
Yeah.
And when you don't have safety, it's very hard to achieve other things. So I really am a strong proponent of this as well. And given kind of what I opened with the statistics around family rejection and discrimination, I'm assuming that the statistics around people experiencing homelessness who are also identified as trans is pretty large as well. Can you speak to that?
Yes, definitely. And the Injustice at Every Turn survey that was done in 2015, over 24% of Black respondents said they experienced some type of housing discrimination in the year before that survey. And also that included being evicted or denied, being able to rent an apartment or a home. And 21% of those people also experienced homelessness at some point in their lives.
And are these Black
also related
trans folks?
Yeah, these are Black trans people. So the Injustice at Every Turn survey is broken down actually into categories, Black folks, Native Americans, the Latino community, but also the community as a whole. Yeah.
And that first statistic, again, you said was 24% of the Black trans respondents said?
Yes, that they had experienced some form of housing discrimination in the past year. So, before 2015. And 21% had actually experienced homelessness at some point in their lives.
So basically, for the overwhelming majority of folks, that housing discrimination led them to be homeless.
Definitely. Yeah.
Wow. It kind of it's overwhelming to hear all this. But I also know that sometimes when you pull together the most marginalized and discriminated against communities also have such incredible resilience and power. Can you talk about that?
Yes, and that was one of the things that I wrote in that New York Times short piece about the resiliency of the trans community, where a group of amazingly resilient people. And I know sometimes that resiliency can kind of become, you know, a blasé term, but it really is important to know that resiliency, not everyone is born with it, but we can help people learn resilience. So if you don't have it, know that you can get it. And I think the trans community rely on their resilience so much because at some point in time, that's all most people have is their own resiliency, their own internal feeling of hope for the future. And so that's why we're able to move through so many of these traumatic experiences, you know, like the housing discrimination, the job discrimination, the restroom issue, not being able to use restrooms of the gender that you identify, and especially the violence that trans women experience in this country when it comes from men in general, you know, just because of, you know, looking at a trans woman, a man might think, you know, this woman is trying to trick me into believing she's a woman. So, you know, building on that type of resilience is important for our community to continue to do so that we can continue to do the advocacy work that we do.
And what does resilience mean to you? How do you think about it? Were you born with it or did you learn it? Talk about your personal experience with resilience.
I actually believe I was born with it because I started experiencing trauma from day one out of my mom's womb. So I definitely feel that I was born with it because of the trauma that was happening to me inside of her stomach and outside of her stomach. It helped me get through anything that ever happened in my life, you know, from the physical abuse to the emotional abuse to the sexual abuse. To the bullying, to the suicide attempts, to my own experiences with homelessness as well. So I've been able to move through all of those experiences, you know, from being houseless to, you know, being a suicide attempt survivor because of my resilience, but also because I had hope that there was a future. So resilience and hope are definitely tied together always for me. And so I'm always remembering that I have strength that I can move through this. Sometimes, you know, I may think, you know, I can't do this. You know, I'm tired. I'm giving up. But the main thing to remember for me is that, you know, you felt this way 15 years ago, but remember when you actually fought it and you moved through it, you know, you actually achieve an outcome on the other side of that, like we're actually able to move through that trauma or, you know, that devastation and actually have a good outcome after. So just keep going, wake up tomorrow, talk to people, reach out to people, and you'll be able to move through this because everything can be worked through.
You are such an inspiration. I love what you said there about really touchstoning back on, I've been here before. I got through this before. I can do it again. And then I just got to get up tomorrow and just keep going. It's really powerful.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that, Sally. And even I still struggle with that today. Like, you know, yes, I've been through this 5, 10, 15 times in my life. I can get through it. I know I can. But sometimes it's hard to remember that. And so that's where you, like, have to have that community And, you know, especially for me in the last 2 years, like having a community to help me sort through my last attempt was very important, because I don't think I would have made it if I didn't have that community. You know, like Ursula, she was my Diva one too. You know, being there for me over the last 2 years. If I didn't have her, I don't like know where I would be right now at this moment. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm talking about our wonderful, wonderful friend, Ursula Whiteside, who is just a godsend to this earth. She is just so solid in her support, always, always saying the right thing. It seems like when people need it, she has this intense intuition of reaching out in those moments to say, you got this, I got you, and we love her so much. And so you bring up another point too around this, that you know, in the face of the number of trauma and discrimination and barriers and adverse things coming at you, resilience is hard to maintain, and that it's going to wax and wane over time, and that, you know, people, regardless of the circumstances, if that's coming at you 24/7. There has to be some points in time where there just needs to be a little bit of hunkering down, surrounding yourself, mm-hmm. you know, with the most supportive, most safe people to regain that energy to come back out. And that you can't always be up there carrying the flag for all of these things all the time. At some point, there has to be a little bit more of self-care and kind of turning inwardly a little bit more to kind of regain that strength. And so, and you are like a pioneer and a forerunner for so many of these really challenging topics for the general population, that it's a lot on your shoulders sometimes, I can imagine. So it would also, you know, what fuels your soul. So it's good. So we've touched on a little bit of the research. I just wanted to open up anything more you wanted to say about some of the research, not just behind the challenges facing the trans community, but also what do we know that works? We talked a little bit about housing. Are there other things that the research is telling us is helpful in the well-being and resilience areas of the trans communities?
Yeah. Definitely for young trans people, I know a lot of families and community members want to do conversion therapy on young people. The science behind it says it does not work. It actually traumatizes the young people. It traumatizes the adults as well that are forced to go through conversion therapy. And luckily, the federal government during the Obama administration recognized that and work towards ending conversion therapy. So I'm just, you know, wanting the community as a whole to continue to fight against conversion therapy, especially for young people, because, you know, it damages the minds of young people, and they become adults who have been traumatized and who will potentially have mental health issues and addiction issues. So we want to make sure that they're not going through conversion therapy and jeopardizing it.
Absolutely. And I just want you to talk a little bit more so our listeners know what this is that we're talking about, because I'm not sure that everybody who's listening is familiar with conversion therapy, what it's intending to do, and what it actually does. Can you talk a little bit more?
Yeah. Basically, conversion therapy started, you know, for considered gay or lesbian. And it was to change their thought pattern, to make them, say, for instance, a gay man, to instead of being attracted to another male, conversion therapy was supposed to help him become attracted to women. So it's been found that conversion therapy leads to depression, to other mental health issues, also trauma and people becoming, you know, addicted to drugs and alcohol as well. And we've known this for 6-plus years now, but lately, the last decade or so, conversion therapy has come back to the forefront, especially because a lot of people are using conversion therapy for young trans people. And we're finding that young people and actually completing suicide at a high rate because of conversion therapy. And one example was Layla Alcorn, who died in, I think Layla passed away in the winter of 2014. Because her parents were forcing her to have conversion therapy, and it was increasing her depression. She was already suffering from depression, and the conversion therapy increased her depression. And Layla ended up ending her life, but before she did that, she left a letter asking us to, you know, stop conversion therapy and to let young trans people live their lives so that they can become healthy adults.
Another unbelievable tragedy. I'm so sorry. And my understanding, too, about conversion therapy, it's not just changing the thoughts. In some forms, there's actual pairing of shocks and other really adverse stimuli with the thoughts of attraction, same sex, or other things. So it's really a very punitive and barbaric type of therapy. So it's not surprising to me that we're having all of these other problems from it. And we absolutely need to continue to fight against it. So we know conversion therapy, and I think we're getting a little interference with your storm too. So again, speak slowly and clearly. So we know conversion therapy is not helpful. What are some of the things that are helpful?
Letting a person live their life, not forcing them into a hidden place where they're not allowed to be able to express how they may want to express, how they may want to present to the general community. That helps a lot. Because not all children that they feel like they're a boy or a girl, actually grow into or become an adult who actually decides to transition. It's probably 1% or less.
It's probably what percent?
Less than 1% of those children that actually grow up to decide to transition as adults or young adults as trans people or gender nonconforming. So it's very important to let the child express their feelings, live those feelings out day by day so that they can make determination as far as to how they want to move forward in their lives. So that's something that's known to work, letting the person, become who they are in a natural, safe, natural, supportive environment.
Thank you. And are there some resources, either young people or their families or adults can turn to for additional support or community or, wellness resources?
Yeah. We have the Trevor Project that is a project that's aimed at young adults. And you have GLAAD, which does a lot of social media campaigns, news articles for the LGBT community as a whole. And you also have It Gets Better Project, Hope for LGBT.
I missed that. Can you say that one again?
Yeah. It Gets Better Project, Hope for LGBT.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And you have the Trans Lifeline, which is suicide in the transgender community.
So can you, my listening to reactions and responses to the It Gets Better Project, it appears that it's been a little bit mixed. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that project and its impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm the type of person that believes we should have as many of these projects as possible to the LGBT community, but especially young people, because not one project would be 100%. yep. Some things will reach some people and some will reach other people. So to me, that's a handful of people. And so I think that this project has done a great service for the community, because enough people that it's, you know, it has actually helped them with resources, that type of thing. So I think it's a success in that way.
That's a very good frame, Aiden. Thank you. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it might not work for everybody, but for those it works for, we're so glad it's there. And, you know, when we talk about resilience, that is the mantra, right? The mantra of resilience is, this is going to get better. This is going to get better. Yeah. I'm going to learn from this. Yeah. I'm going to grow from this. I'm going to advocate against whatever the thing that's happening to me is. All of that's part of the it gets better mindset of resilience. So thank you.
And it's always good to see yourself and the media. And the stories that the Hope Project presents, it shows a little bit of everyone from our community, you know, from every ethnicity, from all those small pockets of different cultures. Like, you can find those stories on that Hope page.
What is this, the Hope Project?
Yeah, the Hope Project.
I don't know the Hope Project. Tell me more about that.
Know they have videos of people talking about their experiences. The It Gets Better Project is the same thing. I call it the Hope Project.
It's Get Better is the Hope Project. Okay, sorry.
It's similar to Desiree Stage's project, similar to Dior Vargas's project, where, you know, it's showing different voices talk about their experiences and how they were able to live through it. And it's important that young people can see those people that look like them, because that is what will spark that hope or that resilience.
So I was just referring there to Desiree Stage's Live Through This project, which I've mentioned many times on this podcast and many other places, because I think it's such a powerful model of storytelling that can inspire hope, can inspire people to live through it, to stay with it, because of all of the faces and all of the stories, you're bound to find something that's connected to your world where you can say, huh, you know, if that person can do it, maybe I can too. So we love you, Desiree. Talk a little bit more about GLAAD, because I do also think that because families can find the trans experience confusing if they didn't have it in their own upbringing, or they'll read a whole bunch of misinformation. Families can really contribute to the hardship of trans people. And what does GLAAD do that helps them?
Yeah. GLAAD has a lot of social media projects going on. They also help people be able to better tell their story. They offer trainings across the country. They work with trans allies. They work in the LGBT community as a whole. Just being able to help stories become something a little bit more personal, but also creating documents around terminology, equality, diversity and inclusion, equity. So GLAAD is really the place where we get a lot of our social media print-type experience from, and they come from the entire community across board, the LGBT community. Yeah.
So that is a place where families can get information and find support with other families, or are there additional resources for families?
The best place for families would be, it was right on the tip of my tongue.
Is it PFLAG?
PFLAG, yes, PFLAG.
Yeah.
Yeah, PFLAG. And I haven't done much with family work, so I'm not going to, like, try to, you know, delve into that much. But the PFLAG is PFLAG.org, PFLAG.org.
I will definitely put that on the resource page as well. Yeah, go ahead.
All right, yeah. And so they do a lot of family work, and they've been around for years, and they you know, definitely include the trans community, you know, talking about trans youth, trans young children.
Thank you. All right, so we've covered a lot of ground here, and you've just given us a nice list of resources that people can turn to. What are some of your top-level kind of strategy takeaways? What are maybe a couple of handful of things you would like our listeners to do or think or be after this podcast that might be different?
Yeah. So my life has changed so much in the last 7 years, but especially in the last 2 years, my life has changed greatly. And one of the greatest lessons that I've learned how to do is to ask for help, to tell people that I love them, and to reach out when I need to talk to someone. Those three things have been lifesavers for me over the last 2 years, but especially asking people for help, because having grown up the way I did in foster care, one of the survival tactics that I learned was that I was the only person I could trust. And so having to break that old habit has been really hard for me. But over the last two years, I worked really hard to bring other people into my life that I could trust, and knowing that I can trust these people will help me even more in the future to bring in other people, you know, into my heart, and not wanting and being okay with being alone. So that's something that I think everyone should, you know, if they can and if they want to try to practice, and that's asking for help, reaching out for a connection, and, you know, telling other people that you love them. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, going back to our wonderful friend and colleague, Ursula Whiteside, one of the things that she does so well and advocates so well are what, you know, we call in the world non-demand caring contacts. And I'm sure you've received some from her. I've received some from her. These are so simple, and they're free, and they're so profoundly powerful to the receiver and the giver. And the gist is, you just let people know that you matter,
yeah,
and that you're thinking of them, and that you love them. And you do this in a moment. You know, it takes less than a minute to form a text or leave a voicemail that just says, I love you, or I think about you, or I care about you. And that's it, period. No, did you take your meds? No, did you go to the therapist? No, can you tell me about the thing?
Uh-huh.
Nothing, just love. And I love it. I absolutely love it. I talk about it everywhere I go, because everybody can do it. Yeah, cost nothing.
Yeah.
Wow. All right, so I'm gonna do my best here to try to kind of summarize a little bit of our discussion. And then I'm going to come back to you for some final thoughts, Aiden. So you can take a moment here to collect an idea or two that you want to make sure that our audience doesn't miss. So at the beginning of our conversation, I highlighted some pretty daunting data around what is contributing to suicidal despair among the transgender populations, including rejection and discrimination, trauma and assault, internalized transphobia, and the powerful complications of intersecting identities. And I'm making an argument that this is really much more of a social justice issue and not as much about mental health, although mental health is certainly impacted. It's subsequent to the social justice issues, and that if we really want to get in front of this, it's about fighting the injustice. And then we talked about your incredible past, which I will highlight the articles in which you're highlighted in and the campaigns that you've helped lead. You have led truly a remarkable life. You started off your story really highlighting the power of adverse childhood experiences to shape early thinking and experiences, whether that's you know, social workers within foster care system that didn't understand you or the bullying and trauma that you experienced in school, and having to, for so long, needing for survival to hide your identity so that you would be at the very basic level safe. And you did that for so long. Your quote was, "I lost it myself." You said, "I lost my identity myself." Until you found it again. And I can't imagine, like, existentially how profound that must have been for you for so long to lose your own identity. So I'm so grateful for that 2007 Newsweek article that helped you find your way into living full-time as the person you always thought you were, which is such a beautiful way to say it. We talked about the second catalyst. So that was kind of the first catalyst for you of really coming into being able to live in the identity that you always knew that you were, and starting your transition of just living your life as a man. And that the second catalyst really came after a very devastating tragedy in 2011 when an intern was murdered, and how the community came together and you witnessed other folks being activists in this space and realized, quote, "I couldn't be silent anymore. I had to speak out for safety." And what tremendous work you've done in this space, just with the bathroom issue alone. I don't know that the general population has a real sense of how difficult that specific issue within the trans community is. And you, again, have led a very strong campaign to have bathroom access for trans population. We talked about a little bit about the intersection of mental health, trauma, and suicidal thinking, especially among people of color, and really looking at the violence issue in particular, and going again back to safety. Your work in the housing cause is monumental, and one of your professional highlights. Because I do believe if people feel safe and secure, they are much better able to find their footing so that they can start to overcome or work through some of their challenges with mental health or addiction, and then be able to live. I mean, that's not necessarily a first and second. Sometimes they find a thing that really inspires, and they can start to work towards living a life of passion and purpose. We talked a lot about resilience, and I do think this is the core takeaway message of our conversation today, is that there are many pathways to resilience. Like you said, not everyone is born with it, but it can be taught, and that the trans community, because of all they have lived through, is incredibly resilient, and people are able to touchstone back on previous trials and reach out and really develop this community that helps them stay connected. We talked a lot about conversion therapy and how it's not working and causing trauma that increases suicide rather than, quote-unquote, fixing people, and that we need together as one of the social justice issues that we're promoting is to really make this illegal and ban it for good, so that people can live their life. And you advocated for young people who are exploring gender identity, an opportunity to explore that, to try it on, to see what it feels like, and to just be themselves in that process. You listed tremendous amounts of resources. They'll all go on our podcast page. And then your three takeaways are really about connection, all of them, about how difficult it is sometimes for people who have had multiple trauma experiences to trust, but how important it is to ask for help, to let people know that you love them, and to reach out for connection, that you don't have to do this alone. It's pretty awesome. Aiden, thank you. So final thoughts that you might have as we close here?
Wow, that was a recap of a lifetime.
Right? I know. I love that's my favorite part of the podcast is like, do you realize what we just talked about? It's pretty amazing.
Definitely.
What are your thoughts?
I just you know, I'm thankful that we had the opportunity to do this conversation. it made me think a little bit about the conversation we had a few months ago when you came to D.C. for the Life. So this is an extended version of that conversation. So I'm just really thankful that I was able to have this with you and, you know, the other people that were actually able to hear it. It just fills my heart, you know, with love. I'll send you some more resources because there are, you know, a lot of resources that people can, you know, utilize to help them move through, you know, whatever they may be thinking about sexuality or gender identity, you know, their expression, you know, so that they can connect to those resources. I just want people to know that if you're thinking about suicide, I know the shame that can be around that. You know, just thinking about it, you know, there's a lot of shame that comes with that. Reach out to someone, you know, ask for help. There are plenty of people in the community that want to be there for you. All you have to do is just find that one person. It doesn't have to be 15 people or 30 people. All it has to be is one person that you can connect to help take you through that day. And then the next day you get up and you do the same thing again. It can be the same person or it can be a different person. And just doing that until you get to the point you feel strong enough that you can stand by yourself and walk through the day fully by yourself as the person that you are. It's about living your full potential, not just surviving, but being able to live to the full potential that you have within your spirit, within your heart, and your soul. So peace and love to everyone.
Thank you. Perfect. So Aiden was also referring there to a video conversation that was recorded in 2018 by the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline of us just having a fireside chat. And so I'll reach out and I'll see if they have produced that yet, if it's up, and I'll attach that to the podcast pages as well. Aiden, where could people find you if they want to connect with you or know more about you or chat with you in any way? Is there a place that people can find you or learn more about you?
Okay. On Twitter, you can find me at Aiden Campbell, and Instagram at Aiden Campbell, and Facebook, the Campbell Center, is on Facebook as the Campbell Center. So
and that's the Campbell Center, right? With the dot in the front?
No, T-H-U.
Okay. Sweet. All right. Okay, so here we came to another end of an amazing hour with an incredible person. Aiden, I'm so grateful that you made this time to chat with me, and really for you, for who you are and all you do. And I'm so glad you're here, and I can't wait to see you again soon, I hope. My heart is also full, and my life is better because you are in it. And I hope to continue to learn more about you and learn more about how I can be a better advocate and activist for the trans community as well. Tons of takeaways for me, and we'll continue to learn and grow here. I want to thank Delilah, who is producing our show today, and all the listeners who showed up. Please post comments and questions and engage with us around this topic. There's so much work that needs to be done. We have an opportunity to put this story, this conversation in front of a lot more people if there's responses and questions and engagement with it. So please engage with us. If you haven't already, please sign up for the newsletters at sallyspencerthomas.com so that you will learn more about upcoming podcasts and Twitter chats and webinars through United Suicide Survivors and other things. And just tell me more about what you want to know. We've got a lot of open spots in season two that I'd love to fill with content that you're excited to hear about. So in closing, I would just like to say our motto, open your heart, change your thinking, take action to save lives. Together we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living. Until we connect again, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pros and the know start with Lowe's, because Lowe's saves pros money toward their bottom line every day. Stop in during Cobalt Tool Days and save up to 25% off a variety of select Cobalt tools. If you're short on time, shop online at lowesforpros.com and your order will be ready for pickup in-store at our Pro Desk. So, pro, now that you know, let's get started. Offer valid through July 31st, while supplies last. See store for details.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it was pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.